Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Writer Charles Bach grew up in Las Vegas and didn't love it much. He spent afternoons reading comic books in the family pawn shop. He watched desperate customers curse and shout at his parents when their hocked wedding bands didn't fetch what they needed. He dreamed of running away and finally did to New York, where he spent 11 years writing a big Dickensian book that is a deeply knowing embrace of the lost children of Las Vegas, its punks and runaways. This hour, On Point debut novelist Charles Bach on American wasteland, unbeautiful Las Vegas, and his new book, Beautiful Children. Joining me now from New York City is Charles Bach. He's winning the praise of a lot of the other new writers, many of which you may have been reading or heard right here. He's been called an American Dickens, and his book, Near Genius, genius or not, it is in many ways a heartbreaker. Charles Bach, thanks very much for joining us today.
Tom, thank you for having me. Hello, my fellow Americans and all the ships at sea.
And all the ships at sea. It's a long time since Vegas was your home, and in all the years of writing and conversation, this has turned you back there in a big way. What's the Las Vegas that Charles Bach wants the country to see?
Tom, my parents are pawnbrokers. When I was a child, after school and often in the summer, I would go downtown and be in the back of my parents' pawn shop and file tickets and roll coins. And people would come in, and some of them were longtime customers who my parents knew very well and would help out whenever, let's say, they needed to pay a bill. And
maybe were usually gamblers? They would come after a bad weekend at the craps tables or just between paychecks?
I think both. Honestly, both. This is before ATMs, let's say. Now they're in Vegas, there's payday loans where you can get advances on your paycheck. And I think when I was growing up, there were much less ways to get money. And a lot of people needed, and even to this day, continue to need pawnbrokers for various things. And they do include bills, and they also include people on long, really rough, bad streaks.
Who need the cash, and there they came. And so this was the face of Vegas that showed up most often to you. Was it beautiful to you as a child? Was it awful? Was it just business?
When you're a kid, you don't know different. You know, I thought this was the world. I mean, this was the world for me. And there were a lot of people who were very nice and a lot of people who my parents would laugh with. What does stick, I think, in a child's memory, and certainly in my memory, are the moments where things don't work out. And maybe I was especially sensitive because I do remember seeing people come in and with certain expectations and certain needs, and maybe then get told, as in your wonderful intro, that their ring isn't worth what they really need to get for it. Mm. And bad things would happen from that. And that did have an effect. And for me, the effect was wanting so much more for everybody involved, wanting my parents to not, let's say, be on the receiving end of some bad names. But also, you know, you feel bad for these people that you stare out and see.
They say the ring is worth they paid $2,000. Your mother or father says, I can only give you $400. And pretty soon there's a kind of a rage unleashed and you're the child witnessing.
I guess so. That's not every day, mm-hmm. but it happens enough. And it's so dramatic. And children, dramatic events like that get internalized and do have their effect.
Charles, would you introduce us to the family at the heart of your new novel, Beautiful Children, the sort of core characters here?
Gladly, Tom. Newell Ewing is a 12-year-old boy. He is obnoxious. He is also funny. He is not easy to love, but over the course of the book, I hope that he is loved. You know, that by the end of it, a reader does feel the tragedy of his absence and of his decisions. His parents, Lincoln and Lorraine, both are specifically Vegas-y type people. Lincoln is a former minor league ball player who didn't make it, and retired to Vegas and became a casino marketing executive and is pretty comfortable at that and a good, decent man. And his wife, Lorraine, is a ex-showgirl who had Newell and at a, you know, 21 or 22, and that kind of ended her showgirl career and made her a mother. And those three kind of are the starting point and the backbone of the novel.
And, of course, everything kind of goes to hell in a handbasket when Newell takes off and then dives into a world of sort of a punks and street kids and lost boys and girls and teenagers and even, you know, kind of eternal childlike adults lost there as well. And it is a very rough world. Can you describe for us why, you know, as you picture this, why does Newell leave his family?
Well, one of the challenges of the book was to not make something cut and dried. Newell, a lot of things happen to him during the book. He goes on out on a Saturday night with an older friend named Kenny. Something happens that they're involved with that influences him. He also has a number of other influences, you know, creeping through his life and personality traits. He's impatient. He wants to be older. He wants to be the center of all attention. He wants many, many things that are natural to a 12-year-old boy. And this is a moment, you know, at a moment of decision or at a moment of drama, things take a turn in a certain direction. It was a challenge to not make it one reason, because I don't know if at the end of the day, life gives us one simple reason for anything we do. But hopefully there is an accumulation of different things, of different levels of importance that add up.
But there's a picture here, Charles Bach, as I read your book, of a family and a culture so kind of dissipated and thin and unnourishing that the sun just floats away. And a pop culture that already had its hooks into him and is waiting for him that takes him any place but paradise.
I think that's true. I think that's a good read, Tom, and a fairly accurate portrayal. Las Vegas is a certain slice of the American dream. There's no way around it. It's everything that is glitzy. It is everything that is fast and instantaneous. It's everything that's immediately indulgent in our culture. And growing up there does have an influence. That does have an influence on anyone who grows up there. There is a certain Vegas style. There is a certain Vegas, almost an air that fills you. And I think that's what people come for 2 days, for 3 days. What happens in Las Vegas stays in Vegas. But there are also people who love and strive and keep the city running. And they're what happens, you know, they also stay in Vegas. And what happens with them? And this is the first, I guess, supposedly definitive or non-definitive or attempt to deal with some of those questions. I'm sure it won't be the last.
It's pretty bleak. I mean, we know what's waiting for the tourists and gamblers when they come to town on the Strip. Fake gondolas and fake Eiffel Towers and all the rest. But it's an awfully bleak wasteland when your Newell Ewing falls out of the nest. What's out there for him and his, you know, cohort?
Well, first of all, I do believe that every character in this book is composed with love and with all the best intentions of humanity, and that hopefully
even the strippers, even the porn folks, even the guys lost in their video games forever, even the sort
I
of
think so. I think so. Yeah, I would. I've had many people tell me that the stripper Cherry Blossom is one of the favorite characters they've ever met in a book. And I believe one of the goals of the book was you start with his family, who is very identifiable with. It's very easy to identify with them. And as you move along, you care about them. But you start to meet people who are a little more on the fringe and more on the fringe. And as the story picks up momentum and drama, they come along and you learn about them and you start to care about them too. The reason it's called Beautiful Children is based on that idea that all God's children are beautiful. and that there is a fundamental humanity to the people who do line the broken streets, and that there is something inherently worthwhile in all of us. And one of the challenges of the book, and I guess I achieved it to various levels of success, is to get a reader to make the whole journey and to care about everyone. It's a hard challenge, and it's a high challenge, and I'm not the person to say whether I succeeded or not, but I know I gave it my best.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with debut novelist Charles Bach about his big new take on America's lost kids and the glittering wasteland side of Las Vegas. His new book is Beautiful Children. Charles Bach joins us from New York, and there are many more characters we want to meet here. One of them, you call the girl with the shaved head, and there's a moment you describe touching, troubled, between her and her mother, who lives the Vegas life, comes home with her troubles, and the girl spinning on out of that into a street life that's going to be very rough-edged for her. I wonder if you could read just a bit for us from maybe a passage there in Beautiful Children, Charles.
I'd love to, Tom. The only thing a reader should know is there's a point where it breaks and it moves back into from the inside of her head into the inside of a party that she's at,
and a street friend of hers named very very Pony appealing Boy. But a bit dangerous named Pony Boy.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Thank you, Tom. Okay, here we go. See, the girl's mother, she used to come into the girl's bedroom two or three times a month, usually late, 2 or 3 in the a.m. She'd get home from another terrible date, or maybe after the latest guy had bailed. It would be the tail end of another night at some honky-tonk or when she just could not sleep. The girl's mother would not be able to handle being alone, and so she would come into her daughter's bedroom. She would slide in under the covers and wrap her arms around her daughter. Locking her bedroom door when she went to bed seemed cruel to the girl. It seemed wrong. She'd leave the door unlocked, and her mother would get into bed and would form a cocoon around the girl's body. Most of the time, the girl pretended to be asleep. If she actually was asleep, then upon her mother's entrance, the girl would wake to a crush of hot breath and whiskey and perfume, and she would hear her mother weeping. She would hear how much her mother hated men, how much her mother hated her own life. The girl would lie there feeling helpless and trapped, and also that her mother was kind of pathetic. And although the girl had a tender and unspeakable love for her mother, she felt distant from her mother, too. The girl was strong. She was smart. She was never going to end up like her mother. No freaking way. And this is when Pony Boy ambled to the back. Pony Boy of the Gibraltar biceps. Pony Boy the beautiful. He said, scoot over, and simple as that, there he was. There they were, scrunched together on the ice cream truck's spare tire.
Charles Bach reading from Beautiful Children. And there, right in one passage, you've got two big themes here. I mean, one, the kind of endlessly bleak, thin, empty, unmoored life that the adults and kids seem to face here. And then, weirdly, but maybe predictably, around it, this erotic fringe sort of around everything, the presence of sexuality always at the edge of things. Let's look first at the bleakness. I mean, is this the America you see? One reviewer looks at the book, reads it, and reminds us of the phrase, you know, describing America as a country of war of all against all, and the kind of bleakness that suggests. Is that the country, the culture you see?
I don't know. I do know that most great literature has to deal with the question of how do we live in this world. Dostoevsky's The landscape he created for Crime and Punishment was bleak. Dickens' Dubliners is not a happy, wonderful place. There is a question to being alive that, and how do we live, and how do we move through this world? And I think the time when I was writing this book, it took me 11 years, but seven of them are Bush years. There were eight of them Bush years, and a lot of things happening in the country, and a lot of things just happening in that are the nature of American life that are interesting because they contain drama and they contain heartbreak. And the life of someone whose first marriage didn't work out and who moves to Las Vegas and who has a job maybe she doesn't care about and is doing her best to raise her daughter and who goes out on dates that just don't work out and comes home and is sad about it, that, you know, maybe it's not the happiest, shiningest truth, but there's something worthwhile and something heroic about soldiering on and doing the best you can. And I tried to write a love letter to the people where it doesn't quite work out. And maybe in some eyes that creates something very, very bleak. In my eyes, it creates something very different and not exploitative, but something hopefully that is raw and deeply, deeply true.
You call it a love letter, and I feel that in the tenderness with which you treat the characters. But I'm also feeling a deep outrage somewhere back in the motivation for this book. I mean, the sort of dehumanizing, debased lives in which these kids end up finding themselves at many moments feels as though it drove you from the start. Or do I misread?
Oh, the first draft of this novel was very, very angry. And certainly there is a level of anger and outrage about maybe the landscape and about what happens. And at the same time, I would wonder if you, when you get home sometimes after being stuck in traffic and after dealing with another bureaucratic jerk and all the machines that go wrong, if you aren't outraged. I think everyone at moments, you know, you look at life and it's impossible not to get outraged. And Las Vegas contains a lot of elements that, you know, it's easy that it's make good subjects and that when I was writing the book, pornography took off. Those people are people with every bit as many hopes and dreams as I have. But look at how it gets skewed in the absurd directions it moves in. That makes for good fiction. It just does.
Let's go to our listeners. Anne is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air with Charles Bach.
Hello.
Hey, Anne.
Hello. I just woke up and heard in the midst of what you've been saying. And it reminds me of the Threepenny Opera.
Oh.
And of...
The Threepenny Opera. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just the phrase, for love or money. Remember in Oscar Wilde?
Yeah.
And in the importance of being earnest. And just of the awfulness of people everywhere and every time looking for love and just coming up with the not reasonable facsimile.
Right.
Everybody's
right.
Just chasing it. It's what everyone's looking for. And so everyone who can't quite find it and has to hang on to whatever they've got instead. And it's so sad. And it can be... And it's so, so possible for people to hold out for the real thing. And it isn't as hard as it might seem.
Mm.
Because you don't know that it's possible to find the real thing. Everybody hopes that they can. But then if they feel that it isn't possible, can give up and accept whatever they think is the only possibility that they can ever find in real life.
And you've put your finger right into something like the heart of a big piece of what Charles Bach writes here. I mean, Charles, your characters are not at all sure what they're holding out for, what they should hold out for, or if there's something out there beyond the barrenness they often find.
Absolutely. That was a beautiful call, or lovely, and it was really poignant because there's so many truths in it and so many things that as you said, Tom, do strike at big questions and the kind of questions that I think fiction deals with, you know, as well, if not better than anything else. You asked me a couple of times or mentioned, you know, teens and the bleakness and the questions of our culture. It's understandable to me, a 15-year-old who's isolated and in his room in the mid-90s listens to Marilyn Manson's Antichrist Superstar, which by my thinking is a superb rock album. In the process, he hears something he responds to that has all kinds of anger and all kinds of angst, and he starts dressing in black, and he starts isolating himself, and he starts online talking with other kids who maybe listen to the same thing. And in a certain sense, he finds a kind of community and liberation. And in other senses, he is isolating himself even further and is narrowing his life even further. And so while on one hand, it's kind of wonderful, on another hand, there's something largely dramatic and sad about it. And that question of holding out or knowing what you're holding out for or going down a false road that you think is the right road. I think we've all been down, you know, we've all traveled them and looked back and with heartbreak or with whatever and, you know, kind of that, geez, I can't believe where I've ended up. And that was a big part of, for me, that was a big part of writing the book because I was lost writing it most of the time too. And meanwhile, all my characters in it are on similar kind of journeys with you know, in different ways, but with that grand idea.
But many on tracks that leave them in tough spots. Linda's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Linda.
Hi. I apologize. I'm driving, but I just heard the first few minutes of the start of your conversation, and it just really struck a chord with me because I do feel that it's very germane to what's happening in the United States today. I really think quality of life is going down. You know, the kids are suffering, everybody's suffering. And so I just wanted to make that comment that I do think this book is probably very appropriate at this time, and hopefully it'll start a conversation in this country about improving quality of life.
So it strikes
Wouldn't that be amazing, Linda? Rock on. Drive safely. Good
drive
job.
Drive safely. Indeed. Charles Bacca, we should read another bit here. Things turn sexual at many points, not exactly necessarily in a gratifying way, often an exploitive way. There's a moment where the girl with the shaved head and Pony Boy connect, and she learns something about the street life he's living. Could you dive in there for us with Pony Boy and what he's up to?
Absolutely, Tom. Pony Boy took a long drag of the spliff. Then he kissed her back, opening his mouth to her, blowing a stream of sweetness into her. Pony Boy and the girl kept kissing, and their kiss was soft and wet, and then it was hot and hard, and then it was over, and her panties were moist, the smoke leaking out of her lips, drifting upward. "Damn, you look sexy," Pony Boy said. And damn, she felt sexy. And so he kissed her again, shoved his tongue down her throat, invaded her tonsils like he had a schedule to keep. There was lurching, the van suddenly in motion, the pair sprawling onto each other. The truck made a left turn, began accelerating. "So," Pony Boy said, once his hands were on the girl's shoulder and had steadied her. "Why didn't you give me the digits last time?" She said, "Oh, my God. Oh." Now his right hand was a blur, the scar across his wrist revealing itself as cracked and deep. "Right," he said. "What happened was, I was going to call. Really, I meant to. See, these guys at Circus, it was like, what I mean is, okay, they hired me to do this stag thing with them. She responded, say what? And you kept having to dress and undress. Oh my God. And he said, the number must have fallen out of my jeans. And she listened with some hesitation and took as much time as she needed, composing herself. And she said, so you're bi? Ponyboy's face turned red, whether he was blushing or just overloading, and with anger, he took a moment, sucked deeply on the spliff, then exhaled, white streams bursting through his nose. Hey, he said, they buy me, I'm sexual.
Charles Bach reading from Beautiful Children, and that could practically be the motto of a lot of the kids in this book. They buy me, I'm sexual. I mean, you talk about a line leading too often in American pop culture, kind of through, I don't know, glitter and family to run away and right into the sexual exploitation world, even the porno world. It's a pretty big boulevard in your fictional world.
I do make a connection. I mean, I think there is a line, and maybe it's porn, then run away, but it starts with, on one end, you do have, you know, the glitter and pop culture and Vegas, and then maybe in the middle there's the family somewhere, and then the bad stuff on the other side. And it all can be connected, and it can be entertained, you know, move around with different connections. You know, the lines can leap. That was my decision for this book. Vegas was the perfect metaphor, possibly because I grew up there and saw certain sides of it, possibly because of my mindset, possibly both. It was the perfect setting for this world. And at the same time, I can't stress this enough to any reader out there. I don't think this is nihilism. I think that this is the best of, that there's also the best of people, and our best hopes are also in this book. It's just sometimes they don't all work out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with debut novelist Charles Bach about his big new take on America's lost kids and life in the glittering wasteland of Las Vegas. His book is Beautiful Children. GQ magazine says this is the year's first big, juicy novel. Jonathan Safran Foer talks about Charles Bach's huge and exciting heart. Publishers Weekly says we've got here a portrait of an almost mythically depraved Las Vegas, from the bland misery of suburban Nevada to the exploitive Vegas sex industry, and still they talk somehow about his hope and compassion and humor. Charles Bach joins us from New York, and Pam is calling right now from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Hi, Pam. You're on the air with Charles Bach.
Hi, Charles. I felt compelled to call. I was just kind of getting ready, doing my thing, and I just kind of stopped and listening to the show. A few minutes back, you talked about somebody called. They were talking about, you know, what it was like in having hope for love out there, and I'm a single mom, so I was just listening to that portion that you were reading, and one of the most difficult things is I have two children, and they're rather young, and pretty much doing everything by myself, and one of the most difficult things, and I know I'm not the only one, it's the compartmentalization of I'm the mom, and now I have this other side of me, and I have needs, and I want love, you know.
Sure.
It's a very difficult struggle, and I find I really have to separate out if I'm going to be going out with someone when the kids come home. I just feel like I'm two different people sometimes, and it's just difficult. I happen to be seeing somebody who's nothing short of wonderful at this moment, so there is hope.
Good for you. Good.
Pam, did you hear Charles Bach with his reading about the mother coming home late at night, curling around her daughter in the daughter's bed, and the daughter thinking about her mom, you know, the smell of a little whiskey, a little perfume, and a whole lot of angst, worry, longing in her mother. The daughter doesn't know what to do with it. Did that strike you?
Yes, I did hear that, and that sometimes that sadness would come through, and my children are very sensitive, and they'd come to me, or my son would put on my favorite song and this kind of thing, so they're very sensitive to that. They don't know what it is, but I think they're sensitive to it, and I think you just have to have hope one of the quotes that I have in front of me all the time, every morning, is, I don't know where it even came from, but it was, it's that the universe, as it's unfolding, it's unfolding as it should unfold. I'm not saying it correctly, but you just have to have that hope, I think.
The desiderata there, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Pam, well, Charles, what do you say to Pam? She's riding your motorcycle a little bit there.
Well, yeah, all you can say to someone like that is, I'm glad that you found someone, and it sounds like you're doing a really good job, and that I hear you. I completely hear you. One thing that's in the book is Lorraine, who is Newell's mother. A very strong thread of this book is devoted to her and kind of her grief about when things have went wrong and her son is missing, and combing over the past and trying to figure out how she could have done things differently. And, you know, and there's moments, there are truths. There's times where you do need a break and you do put the kid in front of the TV, or you do let the kid play Nintendo, because you're a human being too and you have an identity, and it's just natural. And that was part of my writing process, was this idea of people doing the best they can. And here's where it just doesn't, in this moment, it doesn't work out. There's a lot of hope. There are people who get through this book relatively unscathed. There's degrees of it. And hopefully the love of life and the love of people and the love is in the language and in the characters and in the details. Because honestly, I hear, you know, a call like this, a call like both of the earlier calls, how can you not want the best for people?
Yeah. I guess everyone does, and yet I have to say I somehow hear you having accommodated yourself in the process of bringing all this on board and turning it into literature to a kind of bleakness here. I mean, the world you describe, yes, there's love there, but oh my gosh, how far from our dream, from our ideal. John Burdett read your book for the Washington Post. Of course, he wrote Bangkok Haunts and others, and said that as he read it, he kept thinking about the opening to Lady Chatterley's Lover. Lawrence writing there, ours is essentially a tragic age, so we refuse to take it tragically. So that kept rattling through his mind. Do you see it as love in a tragic age that you're describing?
I think every age is a tragic age. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do think ours is that at this moment, it's hard not to see the tremendous tragedy, and especially while I was writing this book during the 11 years, to see where our country is, where different people are at. There is a part of, I mean, my hometown is a place that is so that celebrates indulgence. And there's a part of American culture that just is ugly. We all know it. We all accept it. We accept the fact that pop culture is our canon. And a lot of it is horrible. And yet this is something we all have in common. We all deal with it in different ways. And that was, you know, I put myself in that world. And it took me to some very dark places. And there were some times where I could not believe what I was doing. I could not believe the task in front of me. I just talked with someone who knew me when I was at an arts colony when I was writing the book, and they said, every morning you look like this most depressed, grumpy, angry person in the world. Well, I was working on a scene, you know, a long scene involving tryouts for hardcore pornography. That's, you know, that takes something out of you. It's hard.
It's devastating, line by line, to see these people just broken down into this sort of basest condition.
You know, and at the same time, I also knew if I'm going to do this and if I'm going to take this on, I can't blink. And that hopefully a reader is going to be taken on an amazing journey that will be scary and harrowing, but will be enjoyable, and they will care so much and be concerned enough so much about each character in there that they will take the journey and they will come out. The characters may not come out the better for it, but every reader, I hope, comes out of this somehow more connected to all the people that are out there that we don't know, more connected to just the idea of being human and being alive. And that's a high bar, obviously. And maybe my chin hits the bar, you know, and I didn't make it all the way over. But I know I gave it my best shot, and I know that there's tons, and I believe in my heart, and thankfully some other people have responded similarly, that it's pretty close, you know, that I gave it a hell of a run.
And close to that.
I don't know if I can say that on the radio.
Yes, and that world, the world of the street and the children, beautiful children, the name of Charles Bach's book, in tough situations who live there. Let's take a call from Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Susan. Hi, Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr.
Hi,
Bach,
Susan.
I had a comment and a question for you. My first comment is I was able to experience the big rave scene in the New Orleans area.
Rave scene, R-A-V-E, yes.
Yeah, it was kind
of like an underground drug scene. Mm-hmm. A lot of partying was going on. And
I've actually been to raves in New Orleans, yeah. Early 90s. I've been to a couple in the warehouse district of New Orleans in the early 94, 95. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I might have bumped into you. But
maybe we danced. Who knows?
You kind of answered my question. My comment was that, you know, reading a book like yours, I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, or can't connect, think to themselves, wow, what an amazing story and how bizarre it is, and can't really connect. But being right in the middle of a scene that's very similar, where everyone's a little desperate and everyone's in this case for drugs, you know, you don't realize it actually happens. And I guess my question to you is, and you kind of answered for me, how involved were you in this culture? How involved were you with these children to actually understand the reality in which, you know, you're writing about?
That's a really good question. I was very unhappy as a teenager. I was unhappy in a way that didn't send me to rave scenes, simply because in high school, I was 5'10", 135, and no one's going to invite me to...
135 pounds. Yeah.
yeah. No one's going to invite me to a rave. In my 20s, I lived. I did live. And when I was writing the book, I also spent a lot of time talking with street kids. I spent a lot of time reading police reports, researching. I spent time in the adult film world doing a lot of research and talking with people. I also made sure that everything in my book was a fictional creation, that I wasn't going to steal and exploit anyone's life, but that I was going to tell the lie that is deeper than truth. But I did the legwork to create this world. And I was just in New Orleans with my wife recently, and on the streets in the French Quarter, there's now street buskers who are in their 20s and who have dreadlocked hair and are kind of squatters. And they teach each other, or there's some of them who are real musicians, but all of them have, let's say, old accordions or old violins. And they teach each other songs, you know, maybe about four songs as their bass, so that everyone can play. And they really look like a band of something out of a Fellini music, out of a Fellini movie, where they play music and busk for change. And it's one of the most beautiful things. And, you know, they sound pretty damn good to me. I'm not a connoisseur of classical music, but I listen to this and it melts my heart. And, you know, that's out there. That's an odd, interesting thing that I don't know if anyone would buy if I put it in the novel. But that's, you know, there's so much happening in the world and there's so many weird directions things spin off in. And the things that I tried to put things that there's nothing in here that I just, you know, it's, you know, yeah. I guess that's the answer. I'm going to stop rambling.
It may be beautiful on that corner with the musicians, but, I mean, at least through the prism of your book, do not mistake it for simply picturesque. There's a lot going on, and a lot of it is very, very tough. Let's take a call from North Callis, Vermont, and Walt. Hi, Walt. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
Thanks
for
taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, Walt.
You said something earlier, and I think that several of the callers that I've been listening to have said something similar about soldiering on. And you know, I read the review of your book in the New York Times. I can't wait to read it.
Oh, thank you.
It seems to me, though, that soldiering on is what the true kind of heroic figures in our culture do. And I'm talking about the single moms who are still there for the kids, the people who get up every day and go to work. And you alluded to having written a lot of the book during the current administration, when we're seemingly not able to kind of look at ourselves as heroic, because all of our heroes are borderline bizarre in fact, yeah, in a lot of ways. And,
yeah,
and I don't think that you know, if the book is able to focus attention on the fact that everybody, adults and kids, are looking for something, and it's okay. It doesn't necessarily need to achieve this monolithic kind of proportion that we kind of always hold ourselves up to. But, you know, I think that would be one of many great outcomes that could come from your book.
Heroism in Soldiering On. Thank you, Walt. Thank you very much.
I could say this. My parents didn't want to be pawnbrokers. They got up every day, literally 360 days a year, and worked 10-hour days and never bought cars for themselves or fancy clothes. They did it for their kids. My mom would always say, I'm doing this so you don't have to. And you talk about soldiering on and being heroic, and that to me defines it. And I couldn't agree with you more with what you're saying. Some of the parents in my book of the missing child, they do their best to soldier on. And in some, you know, and there's moments where they do stumble. And I think that's part of the human condition as well.
And yet we want to build that society in which people don't have to soldier on in quite such emptiness. We got one more call here we have time for. Sunapee, New Hampshire. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Charles.
Hi.
I was just struck by the theme of this descent into a bleak world of many connections but devoid of community, and was struck by the connection between that and an article in the Times this morning about the growing trend of children being schooled online, and just this accumulation or the accelerating velocity of this severing, you know, the final ties between us individually and community, and the solipsism that breeds. And I was wondering if you could comment on the connection between that and the theme of your novel.
Sort of isolation box. What do you say, Charles?
Wow. Well, one thing that's amazing is that everything is happening so fast. And internet, the ability of to, you know, obviously we all know that, you know, the super web or the intraweb or whatever it's called, it's changed everything. And I'm on it. Everyone's on it. We're all clicking around like heck. And that there is an alienation that occurs from it. And like, there's a message board in the book that that a group of friends communicates on. And if you've ever, you know, like been on a message board and read the arguments that take place, there's a level of viciousness, you know, that comes with just needing to be right and answering people back and taking things out of context. And, you know, there are all kinds of isolating dangers, even as there's also the ability for me to carry on a wonderful friendship with a poster artist in San Francisco who I've never met, but who, you know, we exchange emails and really... I feel like I found a deep friend and almost, you know, almost a brother. And so it's just a strange, you know, it's such a strange time, and everything good also has, you know, a weird effect. And, you know, like all we can do is hold on and see what happens, I guess, because I'm the last person who has an answer for what such a profound question.
Charles Bach, we're out of time. We're grateful for the new book, Beautiful Children. We'll watch how you carry this tag, American Dickens. Fascinating. Good luck with it. We thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I had an absolute pleasure, and thank you to everyone who called and everyone listening. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.